the Eden fighter aircraft were upon her almost before Gorgeous was able to announce them. But in combat, one didn't stand on protocol. Emma Shaw banked the Blackbird into a barrel roll. The three leaders, they were the only ones of the enemy squadron close enough to get at her for the next couple of seconds, overflying her.
Give me my manual on my guns, Gorgeous.
Emma Shaw pulled the Blackbird so rapidly out of the roll that for a split second she almost wondered if her kidneys would continue on down to the deck.
You have manual control, Commander.
A string of high-explosive anti-armors snaked toward the Eden fighter and laced across its portside wing, igniting the synth fuel tanks. Emma rolled right of the fireball.
Five more Eden fighters approaching from...
Never mind. I've got them, Gorgeous.
Yes, Commander.
She had them, but she'd worry about them in another few seconds. For now, the two remaining fighters out of the original three were coming onto her in a big way. She pulled out of the bank and climbed, outdistancing them easily, leveling off, then diving down onto them while they still climbed after her, the G-forces making her regret the small meal she'd consumed before embarking. She saved her missiles, these two in gun range and handily so. Emma Shaw let the one on the right have a burst, knowing she would miss, then banking after the one on her left. She came out of the dive just under him and about 200 yards back. The Eden fighter's exposed fuselage underbelly took a string of hits, the plane seeming to skip across the clouds as if it were air braking. Instead, it spun to starboard, and the portside wing sheared partially away. One of the three originals to go. Emma Shaw didn't even look, which was dangerous, but there wasn't any time for looking. Instead, she dove, knowing that the Eden fighter would expect her to use her aircraft's superior speed and climb away. He was already climbing in order to intercept her. Wrenching her body into near nausea, Emma Shaw brought the Blackbird out of the dive and looped upward.
This aircraft has been targeted. There is lock on by incoming enemy missile. Impact in 38 seconds. Commander.
Shit.
30 seconds.
Emma Shaw banked to port and away from the fireball and burning debris of the third Eden fighter.
25 seconds.
These were not Spider 7s after her, the Spider 7 surface-to-air missiles. Instead, these were laser-locking Penetrator 2s, air-to-air combat missiles which doubled as tank killers. Once fired, they were independently guided like torpedoes, homing in regardless of the distance involved until they ran out of propellant. Her only hope was to outrun them. Climbing as she was now, she leveled off and in the next instant started the Blackbird into a full power dive. The leading edges of the Blackbird's wings glowed red. 20 seconds until first impact. Emma Shaw brought up the Blackbird's nose and banked to starboard, throttling out.
Enemy missile falling back. Second and third enemy missiles fired on vectors.
Shut up, Gorgeous. You're depressing me.
The Blackbird's top speed was so classified that only the program test pilots knew the top end. Although she'd flown in some of the testing, she'd never been involved in speed trials, Mach 9 and passed it.
Alert, Commander. Spider 7 surface-to-air missiles have acquired the aircraft.
Shit!
Below her, barely visible, and well off to starboard yet, were the contrails of three, make it four, surface-to-air missiles.
Additional incoming Spider 7s have been launched, Commander Shaw. They are on intercept trajectory with this aircraft's current flight path.
Below her, there was nothing but snow and ice.
Give me my position on heads-up and calculate position with continuous updates, Gorgeous.
Yes, Commander Shaw.
The heads-up display in her windscreen showed Tennessee rolling away beneath her. The Blackbird's speed was still increasing. The red coloration of the leading edges of the wings was bleeding back across the surface. Friction was giving her the effect of turbulence, the Blackbird becoming more difficult to control by the second. Kentucky would be under her soon.
A total of 9 Spider 7 surface-to-aircraft missiles have locked on to this aircraft as target, Commander Shaw. Impact will begin in exactly 34 seconds. Probability of evasion, 0%.
Fuck off!
But Emma Shaw knew that Gorgeous, however reserved he might seem, wasn't an alarmist. This was it. She congratulated herself for getting Eden Plant 234 blotted off the map. She congratulated herself for John Rourke's almost loving her. There was one possible textbook solution to her dilemma. That was to launch all aft-firing missiles in unison, thus giving her aircraft a speed boost and providing multiple targets for the incoming. Also, according to the manuals, to do so had a better than 90% probability of ripping off the aircraft's wings.
Gorgeous, two things. First, you're a hell of a guy, and if I fly again, I'll get your program, honest.
Thank you, Commander Shaw. It has been a pleasure working with you.
Second thing, Gorgeous. On my mark, computer fire all aft firing missiles and jettison forward firing missiles to reduce friction drag and lighten the aircraft.
As you order, Commander Shaw. I am obligated to warn you, however.
I know the odds. Sorry I got kind of gruff with you.
Good luck, Commander.
4, 3, 2, mark!
The Blackbird's controls suddenly died, but the aircraft shot forward, its airspeed indicator going wild. Emma Shaw forced her right hand to move, her gloved fingers arming ejection control. First, there would be cockpit separating, then retro-firing, then canopy ejection, and if everything worked, maybe she wouldn't be torn limb from limb by the G-forces and her chute would open. Maybe. Behind her, in the aft view display, she could see the enemy missiles fizzling out, falling away. The needle of her airspeed indicator was stuck all the way to the right. The starboard wing was vibrating, tearing away. She folded back the firing panel. The first finger of her right hand poised over the fire control button. She ran a mental checklist. She had both pistols, her survival knife, survival kit maps. Shit. Emma Shaw closed her eyes and pushed the button. No one had ever reported on ejection at this speed because the crash test dummies couldn't talk, and even if they could, they were ripped apart.
Oh, Jesus!
The rush of wind against the few exposed patches of facial skin was bitterly cold. Emma felt herself shooting upward, her body molding into the contours of the cockpit seat.
Shit!
Suddenly, she was plummeting back towards Earth. The seat restraints would release her automatically if everything worked right. That would be in seconds. Below her and far to the northeast, she saw the Blackbird, the starboard wing breaking off, the aircraft bouncing through the clouds as if it were rolling over obstacles. Then, the wing totally gone. Now the Blackbird flipped left, the port side wing snapping away. The fuselage began to tumble then, end over end, cartwheeling, then just exploding. Emma Shaw's main chute billowed out, but didn't open, and in the pit of her stomach she had a sinking feeling like she'd had when her mother died. The seat restraints had not released her, and her chute would never open. Falling. She was falling, and she was trapped in her damn cockpit seat, and she was going to die.
No!
Falling, spinning, then tumbling head over heels, her stomach churning, the blood racing to her head, she groped for the knife that was her one hope. Her survival knife was impossible for her to reach, but there was a little knife she always carried in her flight suit, a little knife she'd found in Lancers once. She had taught herself to open it one-handed, but wouldn't risk that now, couldn't, her body still rolling head over heels. Emma Shaw was close to blacking out. She had the executive edge grande open, slipped it under the seat restraint near the edge closest into the seat but still accessible. There would never be time to cut the X of the harness fully apart, but she was small enough that if she could just cut this one segment, she might be able to wriggle free under the harness. Then, if the chute she wore on her body would work, if there was enough time, she could. She had it almost. There was no time to close the knife. She threw it away, promising herself that if she made it, she'd buy another one. Her body was already slipping out of the chair, and she lurched downward. The V, which formed the uppermost portion of the harness X, fouled in her oxygen mask. She was slipping still further, choking now. Her hands fought the webbing, twisting, tearing at it, all futilely. The chair flip-flopped, and suddenly she was free of the rigging, and she was tumbling. She forced apart her arms and legs, trying to stabilize herself, spread-eagling, like a snow angel in the mountains that rose above her little house. There was an automatically activated altimeter on Emma Shaw's chest pack, but there wasn't time for her to look at it. She was stable. She flipped the release for the safety. She pulled the cord. She was slowing. Her chute was fully opened, and she swayed sickeningly over the snowfield below. Emma Shaw breathed. It was likely that she had been picked up on some aircraft sensing device employed by the Eden forces, and that would mean the bad guys would be looking for her sooner than the good guys. She would have to move. But as her eyes surveyed the unrelieved whiteness below her, Emma Shaw had no idea which way to go. There was nothing for it but to leave Annie and Natalia behind to protect Michael's cryogenic chamber from Zimmer's Nazis. John Rourke knew that, but as the Nazi aircraft which he had just boarded, a V-stall that was identical except in its markings to the state-of-the-art models of New Germany, went airborne, he looked past Paul's shoulder and honestly wondered if he would ever see his daughter and his dear friend again. Hauptsturmfuhrer Gunther Spitz called to him from the other side of the fuselage.
Herr Dr. General, what is your first order?
To stop addressing me as Herr Dr. General. Doctor or just Rourke will be fine. My second order is that you remember one thing. Anyone who doesn't do exactly as Mr. Rubinstein or I say gets killed. If you or your men try anything after we've recovered the remains, they'll be of very little use to Dr. Zimmer because they'll be destroyed. And my third order is just as important. Centuries ago, there was a wonderful television series, and subsequently there were movies as well. It dealt with a group of men and women going off to explore the stars. They had what was called a prime directive, which had to be followed at almost any cost. This is your prime directive. Don't go into this thinking that we're going to kill everyone who happens to get in our way. Judging from what intelligence data I was given by Dr. Zimmer, the society where the remains you seek may be hidden has been unmolested by outside influences for more than 600 years. There is no reason to destroy it. We'll do what we must in order to achieve the objective and nothing more. The first man of you who violates that dictum will pay with his life in the very next instant.
Hauptsturmfuhrer Spitz leaned back in his seat, drumming his fingers on the table near him. The interior of the aircraft was luxuriously appointed, much as then-Colonel Mann's craft had been over a century ago. It was designed to be a highly mobile office, an Air Force One, as it were. John Rourke looked at Wolfgang Mann now, the Generaloberst sitting alone, staring off through one of the windows as the aircraft climbed. Rourke knew the feeling of disorientation Mann must be experiencing only too well. One closed one's eyes in one era and opened them in what could only be viewed as the distant future. And this future was hardly appealing. The last coded transmission Rourke had seen from the deep dive mission assisting Thorn Rolvag before embarking indicated that Rolvag had discovered a previously undiscovered sub-oceanic trench of incredibly vast proportions. Nothing needed to be said further. With the suddenly heightening volcanic activity in the Hawaiian Islands and the discovery of a new El Niño well off what had been the coast of Ecuador, this new trench might indeed be the harbinger of the end. Not man-made this time, but certainly man-assisted. And here he was going in search of the remains of the body of Adolf Hitler, an unholy mission in a wholly selfish cause. And nagging at John Rourke still was a question, the answer to which he might not realize until it was too late. Why had Dr. Zimmer returned Wolfgang Mann, and why, certainly not out of any desire to do the decent thing, had Dietrich Zimmer performed the life-saving surgery required by Sarah? John Rourke clapped Paul Rubinstein on the shoulder, unbuckled his seat restraint, and left Paul, walked aft along the fuselage, and sat down beside Wolfgang Mann. Paul looked back once, then took out his diary. Before Rourke could speak with Mann, Günther Spitz called out to Paul.
And what is it that you do there, Jew?
Well, damn Nazi. Italian.
Hauptsturmfuhrer Spitz's entire body seemed to tense. Paul's left hand was under the table, near the butt of his second Browning high power.
I'm writing a log, as it were, a diary, but more than that, a history. After a section is filled in by hand, it's transferred to a universally translatable hard disk. Someday, there'll be a record of what's happened since the night of the war. A personal record. Documents such as this can be invaluable to historians. I began it after our airliner crashed during the night of the war, before your great-great-grandfather was a tickle in his father's pants. As to being Jewish, I am. And proud, too. We survived, despite what your spiritual antecedents tried doing to us during World War II. We helped to build a better world. We helped to promote understanding. You did nothing but destroy. To the enlightened man, Jew, Christian, Muslim, the label doesn't matter, really. It's what a man or woman does, who they are as a person, not anything else that truly matters. I'm sure, for example, that if I looked really hard, although admittedly it would be challenging, I might even be able to find a Nazi who didn't deserve to be exterminated from the face of the earth.
As Hauptsturmfuhrer Günther Spitz stared across the aisle, Paul, looking for all the world like a gunfighting gambler from a Western movie, moved his left hand forward under the table. The second Browning high power was tight in Paul's fist, the hammer back.
To keep from punching a hole in the aircraft, I'll keep all my shots in your chest. Your move.
Günther Spitz just stood there, limbs shaking with rage. His men, collecting around him, were ready to follow his lead. Paul said nothing, merely kept the pistol still under the table, aimed at Hauptsturmfuhrer Günther Spitz's center of mass.
Our home will come, Jew.
Anytime, Nazi.
Günther Spitz nodded to his people and sat down again, rotating his chair in order to put his back to Paul, perhaps as a show of defiance. When John Rourke looked back at Paul, the high power had already disappeared. Rourke turned to look at Wolfgang Mann beside him. They sat on a U-shaped couch, much like the conventional 20th century sectional sofa, positioned just forward of the aft bulkhead. Behind them, one of the lavatories, the galley area, and some storage space.
It's good to see you again, Wolf.
And you, John.
Tell me, Wolf, what do you remember concerning the time after you were awakened?
Why do you ask? Surely you have experienced the same sensations?
That's curiosity. Please, indulge me.
It was very bewildering at first. I was thirsty, and no matter how much water I drank, I could not slake my thirst.
Huh. You thirsty now, Wolf?
No, I am fine. Why do you ask?
A curiosity. Cryogenic sleep affects every person differently. I felt terribly stiff.
I did not, oddly. But I would have thought that I would.
John Rourke merely nodded, then closed his eyes. Thirst, beyond wetting one's mouth, was not really a problem after cryogenic sleep. Neither of the children, they were adults now, of course, had ever complained of it, nor had Sarah, or Paul, or Natalia. Rourke had never experienced it either. On the other hand, thirst was common after some types of anesthesia, and muscle stiffness from inactivity was intense. One felt weak as the proverbial kitten following awakening. Yet Wolfgang Mann had not experienced this, and indeed, the Generaloberst's walk as he had approached their aircraft earlier had seemed more or less normal. Yet Mann had been decidedly fuzzy-sounding, as if drugged. One of the keys to Dietrich Zimmer's successful microsurgery was the appliances he constructed, then used, surgical tools of his own creation. John Rourke respected that rare thing known as genius, wherever he happened to find it, and Zimmer possessed it. Had Zimmer somehow found something else to do with his tools? Wolfgang Mann had returned to gazing out the window. There was nothing to see but clouds, beautiful to be sure, but repetitive, always the same. John Rourke looked at the primary map he would use of the terrain surrounding the mountain enclave. It was an aerial recon photo transposed over a topographical map. From the look of things, it would be an easy enough climb to the presumed site of the main entrance, but that would not be the way to get inside, a fact which no doubt had not eluded Dietrich Zimmer. Entry to the facility would have to be through subtle means. He was experienced with this sort of arrangement, of course. His own retreat, now a museum in Eden, the Soviet underground city in the Urals of more than a century ago, New Germany's heart in Argentina, all of these facilities, including his own, had one central theme, that the outside and the inside were hermetically sealed away from each other, at least to begin with. That this civilization had not come out onto the surface again either meant that it, the civilization itself, had collapsed, or that their system was so efficient as to preclude any necessity of venturing onto the surface. A true underground city, as the Russian and German facilities had been until the atmosphere outside was sufficiently restored. Perhaps, although that seemed incredible, these persons had no idea that the surface was, at least for the moment, inhabitable. Had been so for well over a century and a half. If the entire facility were sealed and there was no interchange between the inside and the outside world, then the only means of access would be explosives. John Rourke had planned ahead for that. But what he hoped to find instead was some sort of service entrance, perhaps for the removal of waste gases, but for whatever reason, a connection between the outside and the inside. And the heat signature near the very top of the mountain, well to the north of what appeared to be a vast, gently sloping plateau, suggested just that, he hoped. If the society within the mountain had grown, progressed, if for nothing else than the cleaning of their environment, they would have such a waste gas cleaning vent. There was no data to support Rourke's theory beyond the suggestion of a heat signature, but he clung to that nonetheless, his best hope. According to technical specifications, Emma's flight suit would protect her, keep her comfortable to temperature extremes to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and was windproof, of course. Evidently, the temperature was lower. Emma Shaw was cold. She wasn't freezing, yet. But she wasn't comfortable, either. Nothing but snow and ice. Her primary chute was folded and partially stowed in its pack. The high-strength windproof synth silk could be utilized for a variety of purposes. She might make it into a coat in a little while, and the paracord could prove useful as well in a survival situation. Her Lancer pistol was still in the issue holster, and the oxygen mask was still in place, but switched from the oxygen supply to filtering environmental air. This warmed the air a little before she breathed it. She traversed what seemed to be a vast, featureless plain. By her survival compass, she was moving northward, only because, according to her escape map, it was printed on synth silk and tied around her throat now for warmth, there were human habitations to the north that were not under control of the Eden government. She could survive a few nights out here if she had to, and as it appeared now, she would probably have to do just that. But eventually, Eden forces would track her down before her own people could get there to extract her. Alone, here in the wilderness, her gray flight suit sticking out like a sore thumb against the whiteness of the landscape, she could not help being discovered. At last, after walking for what she judged was 4 miles or so, Emma Shaw stopped. She shouldered out of her flight harness and began to utilize the parachute. Using her survival knife, she cut a neck hole and 2 wrist holes in double thicknesses of the synth silk parachute. In this manner, she would be warmer and less visible from the air. She wore a transponding device which would home in rescue forces, so she didn't need to be observable. And the parachute would still be large enough to utilize as a shelter if it came to that. The tube shelter in her survival pack somehow was probably not warm enough. In order to have ready-made guys for the shelter, she cut off only a portion of the paracord, weaving what remained attached into modified hangman's nooses. The rest of the cord she coiled and stuffed into her harness pack, out of which the chute had originally come. When she cut the holes in the synth silk chute, she did so in such a manner that nothing was excised. Therefore, with the emergency sewing materials in her survival kit, she could close any holes if need be, should the weather turn really severe. Emma made herself a cold meal using the rations sparingly. She had a 4-day supply, but how was she to know if that would be enough? Eyes casting down to glance at the radiation counter in her chest pack, she trudged onward again, warmer somewhat once she got moving again with her synth silk poncho. From above, she might look like some giant mobile mound of snow. After what she judged to be another mile, the terrain started to break up and simultaneously rise. And there, ice was more prevalent than snow. She was deep into the glacier now. Another mile onward, she was becoming very tired and needed to rest, perhaps eat again, the cold multiplying the effect of the exertion, and the land just stopped. Before her lay a chasm, incredibly wide, and more importantly, seemingly impassable. At its center, perhaps 200 yards below, coursed a river, blue and silver like a ribbon. Emma Shaw was beginning to worry that sometime during the various twists and turns and bumps and jars her body had endured, she might have done some real damage to herself. Her head ached. That could be shock, even a mild concussion, or maybe a compression fracture. At least, as best she had been able to discern before picking herself up off the ground, nothing seemed broken.
What to do?
And then, as she scanned the far wall of the chasm in detail through her small field glasses, she realized what her best chance might be. If she could take the near wall downward, perhaps here, as in the far wall, there would be caves. If she could rest, perhaps for the night, she would feel better, warmer too. A fire might even be possible, and the river itself might be her way out. It seemed free-flowing enough. As a part of her standard kit, there was a single-person inflatable life raft. The things were cramped and not the sort of boat one would use for a pleasure cruise, but she might be able to use the raft to carry her downriver. This river eventually would flow to the sea. Once she located a port of some sort, it wouldn't be that hard to find the local anti-Eden forces, or she could just connect her emergency beacon to a satellite dish and bring in the troops. Of course, none of these ideas might work at all, but convincing herself that they would, Emma Shaw began to climb, very carefully, downward along the chasm wall in search of a cave in which to spend the night. The Nazi V-Stall touched down with amazing delicacy. Immediately, the fuselage door was opened and Hauptsturmfuhrer Günther Spitz's personnel exited into the snow. The last of them was the mortuary sciences specialist, a man named Kraus. Snow was heavy here and deep in the niches and depressions, but the rock face itself was smooth and reasonably level, blown clean of snow in the nearly gale-force wind. The wind was a further tribute to the pilot's skills. The glacial ice was far below them now. Here at the summit of the mountain, they could see literally for miles. The only hint of civilization was the thought of that which might have survived within the mountain beneath them. If it had, it had remained untouched for 625 years. John Rourke in his black Arctic parka now, but the snorkel hood down and the front of the coat open so he could access his pistols, despite the cold, jumped down from the V-stall. Unslinging his HK-91, then loading the chamber, Rourke started ahead, bending his frame into the wind as he trod over the plateau and toward the ultimate summit. The men fell in around him, Paul close beside him.
There wasn't anything at all?
Not a thing showed up on the aerial photography. Nothing showed up on the aircraft sensors. Overflew it three times, then twice more for good measure, as you know. If they've got anything, it's more sophisticated than anything anyone's operating with. More sophisticated than anything we could imagine.
That's crazy. No defenses? No detection devices?
That could be a community of pacifists. After the night of the war and the great conflagration, God only knows what people who survived might turn to. They might view something as basic as self-defense and intrinsic evil. Many persons claimed to believe that even prior to the night of the war. And of course, there were some very sincere Christian religious sects which held those beliefs. I always believed that brotherly love was something certainly to strive for, but that making self-defense moral anathema was tantamount to suicide.
And you think there's a vent up there for getting rid of poisonous exhaust gases? And that's it?
Maybe. Either that vent provides the access we require, or we plant explosives and then have the V-Stall's missiles or plasma guns detonate them. But that could cause a lot of death and destruction inside. So let's hope there's a vent, Paul.
Wind which blew here on the mountaintop was bitterly cold, but somehow very clean, refreshing, and because of that, almost pleasant. The V-Stall's overflights had confirmed what the intelligence data had suggested very strongly, that there was no radiation danger here, that the air, despite its natural thinness at this latitude and elevation, was perfectly breathable. In fact, it smelled fresher than he had remembered air smelling for a very long time.
Fall back! Fall back! Gas!
John Rourke turned and ran, Paul beside him, the younger man already staggering. One of the Nazis, the medical doctor, who was also a specialist in cryogenics, collapsed, and John Rourke would need him very desperately. Besides that, Nazi or no, the fellow was a human being. Rourke shoved Paul Rubinstein toward Gunther Spitz.
Care for him or die!
If this were nerve gas, Rourke and everyone with him was close to dead already. Rourke grabbed up the doctor, hauled him into a fireman's carry, and turned, nearly stumbled, lightheaded, then threw himself into a lurching run. Paul started running back to join him. They met, Paul grabbing the man from Rourke's shoulder, taking the doctor over his shoulder. Rourke stumbled. Paul reached for him. Rourke shook his head, waved Paul away. Rourke pulled himself to his feet, then ran on. The others were huddled about the aircraft, apparently unharmed. As Rourke joined them, he sagged to his knees in the snow and breathed tentatively. The air smelled normal, not sweet.
Back into the aircraft! Seal everything! Hurry!
Paul was the first up, the Nazi doctor over his shoulder still. John Rourke cursed his carelessness. He was, after all, looking for an outlet vent where poisonous gases generated by industry or waste management could be purged from within. Perhaps this was a defensive system, perhaps not. Either way, it had achieved the same purpose. And he had found what he had detected from the photo reconnaissance.
We suit up before we venture out again. Come on.
Emma Shaw's eyes squinted against the darkness. At last, she closed her eyes and counted to 10, then opened them again. The 45 in her hand felt as comforting as the teddy bear she'd slept with as a little girl. But when she was little, she never let Teddy go first. She let the 45 go first, holding it out ahead of her, as though it were some sort of magic talisman, very much like a teddy bear, and would keep the evil of the darkness away. But unlike when she was a little girl, it wasn't imaginary monsters of which she was afraid, but men or animals. She'd heard that bears and wolves had been released into the countryside by the Eden City officials to restock nature. That was fine, but she didn't care to have a chat about ecology with either. And because the government of Eden seemed almost intent on disaffecting the population, large numbers of persons had either formed independent and sometimes quite primitive societies outside Eden's direct sphere of influence, and gangs of land pirates and solitary roving thugs roamed at will in the wilderness areas. These latter might be worse than wolves or bears, but the cave, more of a deep niche in the rock, seemed uninhabited. Emma Shaw shone her hand flash and inspected the cave in greater detail. There was no debris to show that wild creatures had used this as a home. And she could see why. It was a little cramped. She could stand up, but only barely. There was a solitary rock, almost inviting in its way, begging her to be seated on something besides cold snow and ice. She accepted the invitation and sat on the rock. It didn't feel half bad. Her .45 was in her right hand, the flashlight in her left. If she got out of this...
When?
The cave would have to do. The first order of survival, after remembering not to panic, was to keep one's body in shape, whether that meant food or water or warmth or shelter. She had everything for that. Over the course of her several miles of walking, she had considered just where she might be. The Blackbird's airspeed indicator had gone off the gauge when she activated the rear-firing rockets. And she had already been at maximum, the aircraft's wings glowing red from the heat despite the frigid air temperatures. It seemed clear that she was exceeding what the aircraft was built for, and the classified maximum speed was staggering to contemplate. Had she overflown her area of operations by such a considerable margin that she was in what had been the northeastern United States? She was beginning to think so. In these days, this was essentially uncharted territory. Some settlements were here, and there were supposedly some few gangs of land pirates. That was all. The land was too forbidding for anyone to wish to claim it, although it was, technically speaking, under the control of Eden. She wished she'd studied geography with more enthusiasm when she'd been in school. Perhaps she would have been able to recognize what river this was which flowed outside, and through what area it passed. Mentally, Emma Shaw stuck to her plan, however, holding fast to its eventual efficacy. Even in the harshest of climates, where a river met the sea, there was at least some sort of settlement, however small. If she followed this river long enough, she would reach the sea, reach that settlement. Then she could effect her own rescue. Failing a belief in that, she was stuck. There was no sign of game, a fact which at once both heartened and dismayed her. In the absence of game, there'd be no predators, but without game, she would run out of food all too soon. Then what?
Stuck. No food. No hope.
Her best chance would be that the land pirates got her and decided she was too pretty to kill. And Emma Shaw smiled, thinking there was a fat chance of that. The Vistal, on Rourke's orders, went airborne again, moving back several miles distant from the mountaintop. With the help of the restored Nazi doctor, a man named Mintz, John Rourke took blood samples from each of the men of the party, himself included. John Rourke had planned ahead. In order to preserve the cursed remains which they sought, it might be necessary to have chemical analysis equipment. For that reason, among other items, there was a computer which was designed to sniff and otherwise scan trace elements and identify their nature. The blood samples were run through the computer, its monitor flashing up the entire chemical composition in less time than it took Rourke to light a cigar.
What is this? These elements?
It's just what I thought it would be, at least in part. Paul, take a look at this, will you?
After a second, Paul Rubinstein was beside him.
Look familiar? Think 1960s.
LSD?
Not in the traditional formula, but evidently gasified and with carriers, yeah.
You mean the hallucinogen?
Yeah, apparently. Unless there's some other reason for it that I can't begin to comprehend. Somebody down inside the mountains likes to keep people happy, whether they like it or not, and kill them at the same time. Other elements of the formula were clearly poisonous and lethally so. Captain, have your co-pilot take over. I need a conference.
He might need more than that. Wearing a chemical decontamination suit with full self-contained respiration was rather like wearing scuba gear, but on land it was grossly uncomfortable. It was light in weight, to be sure, but one was forever conscious of wearing it. Paul Rubinstein didn't like it. It was toward dusk when the Vistal touched down again and they disembarked, their weapons at the ready, the pilot ordered to go airborne and select a suitable safe landing site, then wait there to be contacted or return in 24 hours. This time, they were more careful in approaching the site of the supposed vent. Various members of the party were equipped with everything from heavy weapons to ultra-sensitive devices for sensing everything from radiation to gas to high-frequency sound or light. They passed the point where the gas had overtaken them the first time, and Paul Rubinstein could hear the voice of Dr. Mintz.
My Corman reports that we are in a cloud of gas identical in composition to that which we identified before. It is becoming more dense.
Thank you, Doctor. Please maintain the English language updates for the benefit of Mr. Rubinstein.
Of course, Herr Doctor.
Beside John, Wolfgang Mann walked along, spryly enough, Paul Rubinstein supposed. Yet there was still something odd about the once colonel, now General Oberst. Perhaps it was muscle or joint stiffness after the cryogenic sleep, but his mannerisms held the hint of almost mechanical detachment. Why?
We're approaching a slightly visible concentration. Can you confirm that is the source, Dr. Mentz?
A moment, please, Dr. Rock. That is the origin here, Doctor.
All right, everyone on alert.
The party had reached the very pinnacle of the mountaintop, and indeed there was a crack in the face of the rock, from below which gas emerged in a cloud just faintly visible, dissipating almost immediately in the wind.
Scan this, gentlemen.
It is not natural in formation, but made to appear so, I think. Some type of metal framework within and stretching downward until it is beyond the range of the instruments. The material above it is a form of synth concrete or something very similar. The metal is an alloy with which the scanning device is not familiar.
So they do have technology.
Indeed, and it would seem they haven't stagnated over the intervening centuries either.
And now what, Dr. Rourke?
This doesn't appear to be in place for defensive means, so it may still be reasonable to assume that the people down below don't know we're here. Dr. Mentz?
Yes, Dr. Rourke.
Would you concur that the suits and equipment we wear should protect us from this gas, no matter what the concentration in parts per million?
I should think so, sir.
Good. Spitz, get your people to take this cap off the outlet vent and do it as neatly and quietly as possible. The gas must be bled off because it's too dangerous to try to clean from the atmosphere. This appeared to be the only heat source in the aerials. That might mean that this is the only chink in their armor. We have to exploit it.
I am in agreement, Herr Doctor.
Paul Rubinstein was beginning to picture what they might find below, and he didn't like what he saw. Darkness had fallen so abruptly within the gorge that it was almost literally as if someone had dropped night's curtain on some sort of stage play. Emma Shaw had a fire going, a small one, and it was necessary to waft the smoke away toward the mouth of the cave, and even at that, there was still an acrid smell. Her emergency gear had battery-operated heating coils, and she would sleep warm in the night without the fire, but for now, she used it to ward off the feelings of aloneness. Somehow, her flashlight just didn't make it in that department. After heating a small amount of canteen water and mixing it with a soup packet, the result was something thick and yellowish and gluey-tasting, but supposedly terribly nutritious. She had set about checking the raft that would be her ticket out of here, she hoped. The raft's inflation directions were something every pilot had memorized, but she read through them again just to be on the safe side. In the morning, before she set out on the raft, and after she found a safe way into the bottom of the gorge, she would check the river for radiation levels, and assuming they were satisfactory, do some fishing. Before lighting her fire, but after making certain that she was in a defensible position, she used her radio compass and got her position off one of the satellites. They were not all in place yet, and so it was only possible, in this general geographic area, to tap in between the hours of 6 and 9, roughly speaking. By comparing the coordinates that her instrument was passively fed with, her pocket navigation computer, she had her position to within a quarter of a mile. Actual position, however, told her little. She knew where she was, but not what was where she was supposed to be. She was south of Lake Ontario and east of Lake Erie at roughly 42 degrees north latitude and 76 degrees west longitude. If she headed straight east, she would eventually bump into the Atlantic Ocean sooner or later. And the river flowed generally south and eastward. It was the eventually part which worried Emma Shaw, and all the little things along the way. If the river proved exceedingly navigable, it might be that the land pirates used it as well. Supposedly, Eden forces and their Nazi allies periodically swept these areas and occasionally used them for cold weather training exercises. That might be another problem. At last, Emma began to put out the fire. The paper-thin sleeping bag was already pre-warming as she tested it with her hands. A good night's sleep would give her a fresh perspective on her plans. Why had she not begun to execute them earlier? If the enemy were on her trail, she wouldn't get away from them on a little raft on the river anyway. Emma Shaw took off her boots, then slipped inside the bag. Once inside, she skimmed out of her flight suit, leaving the one-piece outfit inside the bag just in case. Before settling in, she removed the magazine from her .45, cleared the chamber, replaced the once-chambered round into the top of the magazine, then reinserted the magazine up the well. Emma Shaw had no desire to shoot herself accidentally during the night, but she wanted to be as ready as she could for anything. With her right fist closed on the butt of the chamber-empty pistol, she closed her eyes and hoped she could make herself go to sleep. Tim Shaw's driver, Bob Bilson, left the car on auto control too much for Shaw's tastes, but Tim Shaw had learned long ago that a side-seat driver was a pain in the ass, so he said nothing. It was almost 4 p.m, a rainy day in Honolulu, and the sky is already dark from the rising plumes of volcanic ash and the permanent clouds they made. It was, in a way, nearly as black as night. His attention was divided, split between the job at hand and thoughts of his daughter shot down over enemy territory. A friend, Commander Washington to be precise, had sneaked the news to him, telling him that even though the top-secret aircraft Emma had flown was down, there was no reason to suppose that she was dead or even injured. She was as good as they came in pilots. Tim Shaw already knew that, and the aircraft type she flew had state-of-the-art pilot escape devices incorporated into its design. Washington's encouragement and Shaw's own innate confidence in his daughter's abilities didn't make it easier to accept.
Shit. What'd you say, Tim?
I said shit, Bobby. That's what I fucking said.
Hey, Emma's got balls, Tim, you know?
Right. But I still say shit, Bobby.
Yeah.
Shaw shook his head and folded out the dashboard computer console, flashing up street maps and acquiring the overhead video monitoring position of the truck convoy, then putting the position into the map. The convoy, 3 blocks up and 2 blocks over on James Madison Way, was moving right along, no sign as yet that it had attracted the Nazis. But logic said that it had to. The terrorist band which had launched the hit against Emma's place in the mountains was the same group which had hit Sebastian's Cove Country Day School. Tim Shaw and his son Ed's SWAT team had hit them where they were hiding and knocked out a half dozen members of the team, found weapons, explosives, maps showing targets, the whole nine yards. But all of the targets would have been changed, and the terrorists had evidently made contact with local fifth columnists to supplement for the manpower loss. And this was only one group. How many Nazi units were in the islands was anyone's guess, with Eden on the verge of an attack. He switched the console so it would superimpose the map image over the actual video image of the truck convoy. The image was blurry because of the rain, and gray like everything else.
You think they'll tumble to this, Tim?
Tumble to it, Bobby? Yeah, I think they did. Here.
Tim Shaw reached over and grabbed for the radio set on the driver's side of the dashboard.
Watchdog to Lamb, watchdog to Lamb. You're wagging your tail. Over.
Read you loud and clear, watchdog. Lamb standing by and out.
This is Shaw. We got some action. Nobody fucking move till we get him ready for the bag. Stand by your radio. Shaw out.
The video display, it was fed to the computer as a regular video, then digitized for added clarity, showed the blue van still dogging the shore patrol. Because of the way the drone was vectoring over the shops and businesses in order to be out of direct line of sight with the street, therefore less easily noticed, Shaw couldn't see the entire convoy of 3 trucks and a lead car. The trucks were the real McCoy, a shipment of surface-to-air missiles for the shore batteries guarding Pearl Harbor, just the sort of target the Nazis would want to take out preparatory to an attack. His eyes stayed on the blue van. There was no way of telling who or what was inside. Only amateurs would have tried to explode the van near the convoy and precipitate a mass explosion of the missiles, because the warheads would not be armed, and nothing would happen. But if enough explosives were used, the missiles could be destroyed, rendered into high-ticket junk that would be useless. Or the trucks could be hijacked, with the intent of arming the missiles and then either using them or detonating them.
Lots of cheerful possibilities.
What was that, Tim?
Just wondering what these guys will try if they go for it.
I bet they stop the convoy, put a truck full of explosives at either end and maybe one in the middle, and blow the whole friggin' thing to junk, and trash James Madison Way at the same time.
You could be right, Bobby. Eddie, talk to your father. Over.
What up, Dad? Over.
Bobby's got an idea. Might be a good one. With Bobby, hey, who can tell? Listen, can you get up a video remote?
From the street?
Yeah, from the street. I need one you can coast in over the front of the convoy.
I gotta clear it with...
Fuck clearing it. Launch it. I need to see if the bad guys got the front end of the convoy tapped. Now do it now and get back to me. Out. Watchdog to Lamb. Over.
This is Lamb, Watchdog. Over.
Both you guys on radio?
Affirmative, Watchdog. Lead and drag car. What's the problem, Watchdog? Over.
You get one in the front like you got in the back. Over.
Say again, Watchdog. Over.
You're wagging a tail. You shaking dick, too? Over.
Negative, Watchdog. Only the tail. Over.
Stay cool. You might be wrong. Watchdog out.
Watchdog 2 to Watchdog 1. Watchdog 2 to Watchdog 1. Come in, over.
Eddie, what's the story?
Yeah, I got a problem. The probe can go up, but we can't control it. The magic box is broken. Won't switch on, so we can't launch it.
Shit. Anybody can fix it?
Negative on that, Watchdog.
Wonderful.
Before Shaw could say anything else, the probe that was already up picked up something and digitized into the far lower right corner of his screen.
Hold tight, Eddie.
Tim Shaw started fiddling with the computer controls, getting the machine to pick up the image from the lower right corner and move it to center screen, then fill in the rest of the image based on data in its memory. What was taking shape was an armored delivery vehicle, the kind used for gold and diamond shipments.
Eddie, still there?
Right here.
Get on the radio telephone and check with the armored car company as quick as you can. See if they got anybody tooling around James Madison about half a block behind the convoy. I'm going to check with Auto Theft. Call me back. This is Tim Shaw. Give me Phil Zimowitz and Auto. Quick as you can, I'm holding.
Tim, what's happening?
You got any reports on an armored car getting boosted lately?
How'd you know? You find it?
Yeah, I found it. I'll get back to you. Eddie, what you got?
Two of the companies down, one to go. Nobody should be on this route, but the guys over at Blackstone Protective wanted to know if we found the car they lost.
All right, make that third call as you close in. We cut off the van that's following the drag car, and then we block James Madison way completely. Sidewalks and everything.
This it?
Damn right.
By using muscle rather than technology, the protective cap of something like synth concrete out of which the gas escape vent emerged was broken open in large sections. Then the sections were set aside for possible replacement. There would be no way in which they could ever hope to have the fact that they had disturbed the cap past detection in close inspection, but from a distance, at least, things might well appear normal. Below the cap was a funnel-shaped feeder leading out of a 16-inch diameter pipe. The sensors, which read the gas content, went wild at the volume. John Rourke stepped back in order to consider the problem.
I hate to say this, but in one way at least, we've wasted our time and our energy, gentlemen. This pipe is too narrow, at this end at least, for us to see it as a means of ingress. We'll be forced to blast our way in, and not from here. On the plus side, the volume of gas indicates that it's being evacuated from a substantially sized chamber below us.
What do you think it is, Dr. Rourke?
But the reason for the gas?
Yes.
I hate to make a judgment based on so little hard data, but it seems quite likely that lysergic diethylamide acid in a gaseous state occurring simultaneous with what appears to be a synthetic form of some cyanide-based compound would indicate that the gas is perhaps used as a means of execution where it is, for some reason, necessary that the victims are in a euphoric state while they die. Hence, this isn't for extermination of vermin or anything like that, but rather sentient beings. I'd say that below us, wherever this pipe ends, there is organized death. It might not be imprudent to infer that the methodology is to some degree or another ritualistic. Ritual takes on great importance in closed societies as well, without the outside influences by which it can be judged.
This sounds like a lecture in basic sociology, Herr Doctor.
Perhaps it's their basic sociology, but I hope I'm wrong.
On Edshaw's signal, the pursuit cars converged on James Madison Way simultaneously with a convoy that was increasing its speed in order to distance itself from the gray van and the armored delivery truck. The armored truck was massive, not powered by electricity, but by internal combustion, powerful enough to punch through most obstacles, including police cars, Tim Shaw realized.
Cut up over the curb, Bobby. Here!
The armored car was barreling up the center of the street, cutting away passenger cars and motorcycles in its path. The gray van was skidding to a stop, sliding doors on both sides opening up. Tim Shaw glanced behind him. Further along up the street, the convoy was on its way, the shore patrol escort cars and one of Eddie's SWAT vans with it. Uniformed cars would be joining it along the route.
I'm gonna break out the grenade launchers against that armored car.
Right.
Shaw had his .45 in his right hand, his thumb poised over the safety, the little .38 special out of his raincoat and in his left hand. The rain was lashing across the street in a strong wind, blowing in cold angular sheets. The snap-down brim of Shaw's black fedora was low over his face, but he still had to squint against the rain in order to see.
You two guys, get a grenade launcher going on that armored truck. We can get him in a crossfire. Stay down. Gonna be a lot of bullets flying. You stay with Bobby here at the car and cover us. Don't spare the suppressive fire.
Then Shaw looked at the remaining six men with him.
The rest of you guys, let's go!
Tim Shaw thrust the .38 special revolver into his pocket and took a bullhorn from one of the men near him.
This is the Honolulu Police Department Tac Squad. You in the late gray model van. You in the armored truck, cease all vehicular motion at once. Step out of your vehicles with your hands raised over your heads and in clearly in view, weaponless. This is a police order. Failure to cooperate might result in your death or injury. If you surrender now, you will not be harmed.
Then Shaw handed off the bullhorn.
Now we're through with that bullshit, we can get to work.
The armored truck was steadily rolling down the street, still about 100 yards off and going slowly now. The men in both open sides of the gray van weren't shooting yet, and Shaw didn't want to have his men fire first, except at the armored truck, and that to stop it. Shaw kept walking, closing the distance to the gray van. There were palm trees every few yards, their trunks good cover as well, because the trees were wide enough at the base. And every man wore body armor. The downside was that the bad guys would be wearing it too. Doring was watching the all-news station on the video screen. There was almost non-stop coverage of Kilauea's continuous erupting. But when the attack on the convoy took place, there would surely be an interruption. And that should be at any moment. Working through his island contacts, he had worked out the attack plan to the smallest detail and let the Nazi sympathizers engaged for the operation run it themselves. If the operation proved successful, Doring could use the same system again, saving his own considerably diminished force for political assassinations and major acts of more subtle sabotage. If the operation failed, it would still terrorize the populace here in Hawaii and doubtless claim some police and military lives. Doring was violating his mission parameters, but under the circumstances, he had no choice. He, along with Marie and the men, had been infiltrated here as a totally independent unit, hence untraceable if the Americans should prove successful in capturing personnel or records from among the other more conventional infiltration teams. But along came an old man, a policeman in a funny hat who didn't play by the rules of the game. He thought like a general, fought like a commando, and killed like a terrorist. Totally without warning, this policeman and the Honolulu TAC team had raided the safe house where Doring and his people had been staying. In one raid, the policeman was responsible for the loss of half of Doring's unit. If the policeman, Inspector Tim Shaw, proved successful this time, before anything further could be done, Shaw would have to be eliminated. The radio set beside him crackled, and Doring picked up his earphone. He felt a smile beginning to cross his lips. Several things happened at once. The grenade launcher from Ed Shaw's side of the street opened fire. The men in the gray van started shooting. The grenade launcher from the south side of the street where Bob Bilson had wedged the car opened up. Tim Shaw and the six TAC team men with him moved for cover, already returning fire as they ran. The armored truck was picking up speed again, big clouds of gray smoke and some falling debris from the grenade impacts on either side of it.
Eddie, take the grenade launcher yourself and put a pair on him. Try knocking out the front tires. Hurry it up!
Tim Shaw told himself to ignore the armored truck, then proceeded to do it.
Okay, you three with me. You guys, go for the other side. We close in on the van from both sides. Give us 15 seconds, then go for it.
Tim Shaw was up and running, the guns and his hands spitting lead toward the open doorway of the van on the side nearest him. Shaw glanced to his left, grinning ear to ear. The armored truck was stopped, the front tires blown off on both sides, and the armored synth glass windshield smudged black. The guys in the armored truck would have to wait.
We're closing in right down the middle in a car, Dad.
You stay here, Bill, and lay down a shitload of suppressive fire, but nice and high up, because we're going to be under it. We're going in. Now!
Tim Shaw saw a flash of movement on the far side, the rest of his men closing. Shaw held his fire, Bill's suppressive fire from behind him, keeping the men in the van back.
Gas grenades! Get them ready!
They were 5 yards from the van now. A man with an energy rifle threw himself into the doorway. Shaw heard the sound of the gas grenades launching into the truck, clouds of tear gas billowing outward on the wind. The gas would be of little practical use, but would at least further confuse things inside the van.
Spray the van!
Dad, you okay?
Bill's wounded. Took one in the thigh. Back over there. Get him some help.
What you gonna do?
Tim Shaw gestured toward the armored truck.
Just a sec.
He turned away, looking after the van. Some of the TAC team people were pulling bodies out of it, living and dead. Fire extinguishers started coming out.
Try rocking her over on the side with the trucks after some volley fire from the grenade launchers to soften them up. And some gas before that to confuse them.
course, that's after we ask them if they want to give up. Your turn. I got to feel stupid the last time.
Tim Shaw's son nodded. There was a bullhorn suspended from a sling across Ed Shaw's chest.
Attention to those personnel in the armored truck. Your vehicle is disabled. You are surrounded. Come out with your hands up. You will not be harmed if you cooperate. You have 1 minute.
Pretty generous of you.
Hey, I'm all heart.
A minute quickly came and went. Ed quickly assembled a dozen tech team members around him.
All right, boys, here's what we do. We have to get the guys to come out of the truck because we can't get inside to get them, right? So they probably have masks, but it's worth a shot to try some gas. It won't make things better for them, that's for sure. If we launch the gas in through those firing ports, and I know it won't be easy, so don't bother mentioning it, they'll figure that's our play for the moment, but it won't be. Once the gas is inside, we fire grenade launchers, trying to get the grenades under the truck. While the guys inside the truck are figuring out what's happening, they'll be away from the firing ports, and we need that. I got 3 SWAT vans lined up on the auto program, so there won't be any drivers to get killed. They're electric, right? So we don't have to worry about fire. So the vans ram the armored truck and, if we're lucky, flip it over. Then we pour everything we got into the underside of the truck. While we're doing that, a bunch of us come up on the truck from the roof side where the guys inside can't see us. Onto the truck, then the nasty part.
Nasty part?
I've got industrial-sized chemical fire extinguishers coming up. Each man who goes to the trucks will have 2 of them. I figure a dozen of those can fill the interior of the armored car with foam, making it impossible for the men inside to hold their positions because the foam will cover the respirator filters on their gas masks, and the smell of the foam, along with what's left of the tear gas, will force them out if they pull off the masks. Soon as they open the doors, we got them.
It was a good plan. A little more complicated than Tim Shaw liked, but a good plan and just crazy enough. No one inside the armored truck would be able to anticipate it, and that was even better. Getting 6 gas grenades inside had consumed better than 15 minutes, and a good dozen more grenades were on the street. Clouds of the tear gas still spewing up from them, the wind driving the rain, blowing the clouds down the street. The 3 remotely operated SWAT vans were in place, but not ranked, so as to conceal from anyone watching from inside the armored truck what the plan was. The grenade sequence was finished, more tires blown out, the body of the armored truck blackened, the vehicle otherwise appearing undamaged. Shaw could see his son getting the tech team men ready for the assault as soon as the armored truck rolled over. Ed gave the hand signal for the 3 trucks to be started out, the drivers aboard them, getting them rolling and then jumping clear. Ed Shaw started his team at a tangent down the street. Tim Shaw, the riot shotgun in his hands, running beside them. The 3 SWAT vans were in perfect synchronization now, picking up speed but obviously in low, coming dead on at the armored truck. The tac team personnel forming the assault unit, Tim Shaw in the middle of them now, were nearly into position. The armored truck seemed to balance itself for a second on the rims of its blown-out tires, then it started to fall.
Let's go!
They were on the roof of the armored truck now, its camel color blackened and smudged. The pavement cracked beneath the roof corners from its impact, a smell of dust and tarmac in the air, despite the rain and the wind. Eddie was the first one up. Tim Shaw clambered onto the cab. A gun protruded out of the slit in the driver's side window.
Gun! Watch it!
Eddie and the other men of the assault unit were already up onto the side of the van, unlimbering the fire extinguishers they carried. The first of the extinguisher hoses was down into the side firing slits, pumping foam into the truck's interior from their tanks.
Be ready if they bolt!
Be ready to fire down into that doorway just in case they're trying to make a run for it!
In less than a minute, Ed's plan worked like a charm. The doors below them moved, one falling open and downward, men from inside, half covered with foam, emerging. The respirator vents on their masks had foam clinging to them. The men had to be choking inside their gas masks. They stumbled or crawled out, firing upward toward the assault team returning fire. The men who had fled were cut down in mere seconds, dead or wounded. Shaw's son directed that the infusion of the chemical foam be halted, then started down to the street level, Tim Shaw behind him.
Hmm.
They entered the van, Tim Shaw and his son, right behind the three men who were the first inside. All of them not only vigilant for lurking enemy personnel, but careful of their footing in the overturned vehicle, the slippery foam clinging to everything. There were crates of explosives visible in the flashlights of the TAC team, the crates wired in series and ready to be exploded. There was a detonator rigged, but the detonator was covered with foam, as were the battery terminal leads.
You made a lucky guess with the fire extinguishers, Eddie. Good tactics. Glad I hired you. If they'd have blown this shit, we would have been sitting on the biggest fragmentation grenade in history.
Tim Shaw walked out, back onto the street, knowing he was no longer needed. And he was tired.